Now, as we look at this passage in 2 Timothy in chapter 1, it occurred to me, well, I discovered to my surprise, we've never actually done any kind of series on Timothy himself. I had thought we had, but we haven't, it seems. And I don't know for sure whether or not we're going to, but if we were going to, then you might think, well, the obvious place to start is 1 Timothy chapter 1. But in a sense, it's not, because that just opens with what Paul is writing to Timothy as his already well-established assistant or lieutenant or helper, who is already taking on responsibility by then in Ephesus. And this, 2 Timothy, although it is almost certainly the last letter that Paul writes that we have any record of, it contains in it certain helpful information which enables us to look, as it were, back to the beginning of Timothy's walk with the Lord. There are hints, as I think I will have mentioned in the past, there are hints in this letter particularly, less so in 1 Timothy, but certainly in 2 Timothy, that all may not be entirely well with Timothy's faith, or perhaps with his relationship with Paul. There's just a little hint that perhaps he is beginning to waver or to quake a wee bit. You know, verse 7 there, God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and love and a sound mind. Why does he need to say that? Unless there's perhaps the suggestion that Timothy is trembling a wee bit, is wavering a wee bit. And he says, you know, put thee in remembrance and stir up the gift of God which is in thee. Why does he need to say that? Unless perhaps it's lying dormant a wee bit, you know. And don't be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, not of me, his prisoner. Does that imply that they've drifted apart a wee bit and Timothy has gone quiet or gone dark? We don't know, of course, all these things. But reading between the lines, there's just a little hint that perhaps Paul is seeking to renew and revive this acquaintance, perhaps because it has drifted a bit into indifference or separation, or the distance between them now, physically, between Ephesus on the one hand and Rome, where Paul is writing from, is too great for Timothy to travel across at the moment. We don't know all the details. We do know this is almost certainly the last letter Paul writes that we have a record of, and it is not insignificant that it is to his faithful lieutenant Timothy, and who he hopes to see again, greatly desiring, verse 4, to see thee, being mindful of thy tears, that I may be filled with joy. When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois, and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also. Now this is helpful to us, because the first mention really we'd had of Timothy as such was in Acts 16. Where we read that when he came to Derbe and Lystra, behold, a certain disciple was there. It doesn't specify that it's a young disciple, but he must have been young at this point, if he's elsewhere written to many years later, saying, let no man despise thy youth. So he must have been young, possibly only in his late teens at this point. He was there named Timotheus, the son of a certain woman which was a Jewess and believed, but his father was a Greek. Doesn't say and his father was a Greek, but his father was a Greek. And the implication is there that his father is not only Gentile, but probably not a believer himself. But his mother is. And from 2 Timothy, we know that his mother is called Eunice. We wouldn't know that by any other means if it wasn't written here. But his mother, obviously, although she has come to faith probably before Timothy, or perhaps at the same time as Timothy, she probably, almost certainly, was not always a devout woman. If she herself is Jewish, and her mother, his grandmother, Lois, would also then be Jewish, it would have been a great grief to a devout Jewish family that one of their daughters would have married a Gentile, a Greek. And yet, we are taught that Timothy, if we turn a couple of pages in 2 Timothy, we find in chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, continue thou in the things which thou hast learned and hast been assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned them, and that from a child thou hast known the holy scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. So whether it was from his grandmother or whether it was from his mother, and this was part of the compromise with his Greek father, that okay, we won't circumcise him, because obviously Paul has the circumcision later on, a couple of verses down in verse 3, but we'll bring him up with the knowledge of the Hebrew Scriptures. Remember that if the faith is going to be that deep in his family, if his grandmother at least is a devout woman, probably he is getting the Scriptures at her knee, perhaps also from his mother, but obviously there must have been a certain falling out in the family. We can again read between the lines, at least in the first instance. But if the boy is brought up at least with the knowledge of the faith, then he must have been steeped in the Old Testament Scriptures long before the gospel actually came to where he was in Lystra. This means that his grandmother is a devout woman. It means that this woman, Lois, I beg your pardon, first of all, has a deep faith in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. People didn't have Bibles on their bookshelf in those days. If he has the knowledge of the Scriptures, then he, from a child, then it means he must have attended at the synagogue. He was probably instructed by a rabbi, even though he was not himself a circumcised, full-blooded Jew. He would have had, no doubt, the benefit of that scriptural teaching. Perhaps they had one or two scrolls of the prophets at home, but it would have been a lot more difficult in those days to be steeped in the Scriptures the way that Timothy obviously was. So his grandmother Lois is extremely devout. His mother Eunice becomes more devout. And the reason we say this, as we mentioned, is that it is inconceivable that a devout, believing Jewish woman steeped in the love of the prophets and the Scriptures and so on would then go and marry a Gentile. You just wouldn't do it. Under the gospel, of course, these distinctions begin to disappear. And this is part of the glory and the spreading out of the salvation of God's kingdom. That it doesn't really matter then whether you're Jew or Greek or Gentile or whatever nationality you might be. The gospel is for all. But at that time, when Timothy is born and when his mother marries this Gentile, that would not have been the case. And the only consolation, if consolation it is, that you can see on the other side is just as her devout Jewish family would have been sorely disappointed that she was marrying a Greek. Probably his Greek Gentile family would have thought he was lowering himself to marry a Jewish woman. So they probably got a bit of grief from both families. And as would be the case in any mixed marriage, there would have had to be compromises on both sides. And probably, from what we have in the text, one of the compromises was he can be brought up with the Scriptures, he can go to the synagogue, but he's not getting circumcised. And that was probably the compromise that they made. Once Timothy is sufficiently grown to accept and believe and profess for himself, that's a decision he can take when he's older, and which, of course, Paul does undertake with him and for him when he wants him to travel as his companion in the faith. Which is ironic, in a sense, given that what they are delivering, you know, him would Paul, verse 3 of chapter 16 in the Acts, have to go forth with him and took and circumcised him because of the Jews, which were in those quarters, for they knew all that his father was a Greek. And as they went through the cities, they delivered them the decrees for to keep that were ordained of the apostles and elders which were at Jerusalem. Now, what is it that they're giving from Acts 15 throughout what is now Turkey and all the areas round about that Paul is visiting? It's the decision of the Council of Jerusalem, Acts 15, that you don't need to be circumcised and that you don't need to become Jewish before you can be a Christian. So why does he do this? The only suggestion we can possibly make is that it is to ease the process of the message. The message of the gospel is the thing that is paramount. And if he was going with a traveling companion, a fellow evangelist, who was a total Gentile, then probably that might be accepted. Look, here's a Gentile, they're believers too. If he was going with someone who's completely Jewish, well, that would be fair enough. But he's going with somebody who, as far as the Jews are concerned, is, you know, a bit of a half-breed. He's neither one thing nor the other. So, you know, how is he, you know, what's his status in all this? Is he just hoping to use the gospel to ride the back of the law and the prophets and so on? And it's not a discussion that Paul wants to have. It's not a distraction that he wants to lead away from the central truths of the gospel. So he's just going to completely take that out. We just have Timothy circumcised, that's it. So the Jews say, you're not really a Jew. Say, yes, he is. He's circumcised, he's learned the scriptures, he's brought up in the synagogue, he's as much Jewish as any one of you now. He's a convert in all of that sense. So it is almost certainly to eliminate distracting discussion or opposition so that the message of the gospel and the message from the Council of Jerusalem can have an unfettered run. Nothing was to get in the way. Now, this is something which Paul himself, in all fairness, practices. If we remember what he says to the Corinthians, you know, he says to a Jew, became I as a Jew, to those without the law, as without the law, I am become all things to all men, that by all means I might save some, to smooth the process of the gospel, the progress of it, and the message, so that nothing hinders the message. He will accommodate himself as much as possible in those things that are not central. And part of Paul's teaching is not, oh, you must never be circumcised, but rather it's that it doesn't matter whether you are or whether you're not. No, circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. If that's the case, then there'll be some situations where it may be a distraction, other things where it may be a help. This is one where clearly he considers it to be a help. Him would Paul have to go forth with him and to concircumcise him because of the Jews, which were in those quarters. For they all knew that his father was a Greek. So that being the case, this indicates that apart from anything else, by this stage in Acts 16, Timothy is sufficiently strong in his faith to be prepared to endure without anesthetic, without antiseptic, and a risk that, you know, an awful lot of blood, an awful lot of pain, an awful lot of suffering, but he's prepared to do this in order to take part in the work of the gospel. That's how strong his faith is at this young, tender age. But we might think, well, where does he hear the gospel? This is Acts 16. Paul has only made one previous visit to Lystra, and that's in Acts 14. And that's where, you know, they heal the man who has been impotent in his feet, being a cripple from his mother's womb, who never had walked. The same heard Paul speak, who steadfastly beholding him and perceiving that he had faith to be healed, said with a loud voice, "Stand upright on thy feet." And he leaped up and walked. And when the people saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in the speech of Lycaonia, "The gods are come down to us in the likeness of men." And they called Barnabas Jupiter and Paul Mercurius, because he was the chief speaker. And then the priest of Jupiter comes and seeks to offer them oxen and bring garlands and to sacrifice to them, thinking that they're gods. And Paul and Barnabas have an awful job to say, no, we're not gods. And they must have stayed with them in Lystra for quite a while. We don't know exactly how long. But clearly, once it became news that the gospel was spreading in Lystra, we read verse 19 of Acts 14, "There came thither certain Jews from Antioch and Iconium, who persuaded the people, and having stoned Paul, drew him out of the city, supposing he had been dead. Howbeit, as the disciples stood round about him, he rose up and came into the city." So by this time, by the time Paul gets stoned at Lystra, there are already believing disciples in Lystra. So he must have been teaching there amongst them some considerable time. It's not just like 5 minutes later, these other Jews turned up and then got Paul stoned. Some time must have been spent there. But I would also suggest to you that at least in the case of his grandmother Lois, this woman who is you know, deep in the scriptures of the Old Testament church, and has brought up Timothy in the same way, and whose daughter then becomes reconciled to this faith and accepts the bringing up of her son in this way, so that this faith dwells first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded in thee also. Timothy, who has known the scriptures from a child, is now applying them. But I would suggest to you that Paul's appearance in Lystra is not the first hint that they have had there of the existence of this message of Jesus of Nazareth. And the reason for saying that is that if we go back to Acts 2, And you see that when the apostles are busy speaking out the message of the gospel, then all the crowd, they were all amazed and marveled, saying one to another, "Behold, are not all these which speak Galileans? How hear we every man in our own tongue, wherein we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites," that's roughly speaking Persia, Iran, that sort of area, "and the dwellers in Mesopotamia," Iraq, that sort of area, "and in Judea," which self-explanatory, Palestine, "Cappadocia" is effectively east of what we would call the interior of Galatia. So it's eastern Turkey, what is now Turkey. Cappadocia, there's people from there in Jerusalem at Pentecost who are hearing the gospel. In Pontus, which is the northern coast of what is now Turkey. And Asia, Ephesus, that area of western Turkey. Phrygia, again, the interior of Turkey, and Pamphylia, southern Turkey now, in Egypt and the parts of Libya about Cyrene, and strangers of Rome, group Jews and proselytes, and so on. So basically, although there's no mention of, you know, Lystra and Derbe and Galatia itself, Galatia was a large, ill-defined area in the center, the big central area of what is now Turkey. And whilst we don't read of any people directly, Galatians, there in Acts chapter 2, at the day of Pentecost, we do read of people round about to the north on the coast, to the east in the interior, to the south on the coast, to the west, in other words, the four points of the compass, there are people there who are in Jerusalem at Pentecost, hearing the gospel, seeing what's happening, who will be there for the next little while Peter and John heal the man who's born lame and so on, who's comes walking and leaping and praising God in the beautiful gate of the temple. It will be having an impact on them as thousands begin to believe, 3,000 souls, you know, in one day, and so converted. So this is, when they go back to their own homes, this is something which is beginning to be gossiped, as it were, to be spoken about to the north, to the east, to the south, to the west of the area where Timothy lives. And whilst it will not have impacted immediately, it will have filtered in. It will have filtered in through traders and travelers and so on, bringing this sort of news and this message and this sort of strange tale that's coming out of Jerusalem, and then it'll be reinforced by people coming from different places. So the four points of the compass round about the interior of Galatia have all heard the gospel long before Paul actually gets converted. So that by the time he and Barnabas come, I would suggest to you that perhaps the people like Lois and possibly Eunice, and maybe even Timothy, are, as it were, primed and prepped with this, what they're hearing about the gospel, so that when apostles, Barnabas and Paul, actually come with it, it's just sort of putting a match to all the sort of paper and kindling and logs that have been put in place. Everything has been made ready, and now they come with a final light, the blue touch paper, and suddenly it bursts into life. It bursts into flame. And whilst obviously their grandmother is the one who lays, his grandmother is the one who lays the foundation, his mother enters into this despite the dubiety of her own marriage previously. As we say, there's always going to be compromise in any kind of mixed marriage, but happily for Timothy, he's been brought up with the knowledge of the scriptures, as we said, from a child, thou hast known the holy scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation. And I am persuaded that in thee also, when Paul comes, this family is ready. They're ready to receive this good news. And his grounding, which is probably an advantage that he has over other believers in the area, who are probably, perhaps they've heard about it as well from the news that's traveled, but they're not grounded in the way that he and his granny and his mum already are in the scriptures. They're not, the soil isn't prepared in the way that it is in this family, so that when the apostles come, he is, if you like, streets ahead of everybody in the maturity and in the knowledge and in the growth and in the depth that he already has. Yes, his mother and his grandmother already have it, but his grandmother is not really somebody who can be a traveling companion for Paul on his evangelistic mission, nor is his mother probably, with a husband and a home and so on, but Timothy is. And Paul wants to take him with him. He is so impressed by the godliness and the commitment of this youth, that he would have him to go forth with him and to concircumcise them because of the Jews. Now, we shouldn't overlook, as we say, just what a test of Timothy's faith that would be. That is really it being put to the test early on in his relationship with Paul. But he has been prepared. He has been grounded. The Lord has been way ahead, even of his own apostles, laying the foundation in the generations that have gone before. Now, although, of course, Timothy is still a young man and probably continues to be thought of as a young man or a young Christian, even as he gets older and even as he continues to minister around the different churches with Paul, sometimes in Paul, along with Paul, sometimes perhaps being sent by Paul, we shouldn't underestimate the importance that Timothy has. He is the co-author of six of Paul's letters: 2 Corinthians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, and Philemon. Timothy is listed as joint author in all of these. Not Romans or 1 Corinthians or Galatians or Ephesians or Titus. Obviously, he's not co-author of the letters to himself. But he is there with Paul in almost all of his ministry subsequent to Acts 16. And this is not because he's only been a believer 5 minutes. It's because he has taken, as it were, the first opportunity to seize upon the gospel and, as it were, to plug this in to all that he has already heard and all that he has already known. The scriptures, that means the Old Testament scriptures, are indeed the foundation, the bedrock on which all of this fits together. And this, of course, is the tack that the apostles themselves used. That when they went to any new place, they went first to the synagogue and they spoke to the Jewish population, because they were the ones, it's their God, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, it's their Messiah, it's the Messiah of Israel, want to say, look, good news, the scriptures are being fulfilled. All that the Lord promised, all that he prepared in the law and the prophets and the Psalms, it's all been leading up to the fulfillment in this person, Jesus of Nazareth. And God has testified to the truth of it by raising him from the dead, and we're the witnesses of this, and so on. So this was a message brought first to the Jew. Timothy's not completely Jew, but he's half Jew, and he's got the knowledge, and it all fits together, and it all makes sense. So he's almost like a ready-made mini-apostle, if we can put it that way. But it didn't happen overnight. All the work, all the grounding, all the gradual imbibing and learning of the scriptures would be the work of years. Years which the Lord has been preparing him, going ahead of him. And if you think about it, even if Timothy is perhaps only like 19 or 20 or something like that, it means that he would have been being brought up with those scriptures almost certainly before the Lord Jesus began his public ministry in Galilee. When Timothy began to be taught these scriptures, Jesus would probably still have been working in the carpenter shop in Nazareth. He wouldn't have started yet. John the Baptist probably hadn't started in his ministry. And there was the Lord still preparing Timothy as a boy, working away through his grandmother Lois, through his mother Eunice. And despite the difficulties of his home life in that regard, preparing this boy for what was to come. Now, the good news in that regard is that the Lord provides everything that will be needed. He never fails to give his servants, whether it's Timothy, whether it's Paul, everything that they will need, all the tools, all the equipment they will need for their particular task, for their particular ministry. I think you made reference in the past, Jacob, you know, you could say references this because when he has his vision of Jacob's ladder at Bethel there, and he has his dream, Genesis 28, verses 20 and 21, Jacob bowed a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. It's not a big request, is it? You know, food to eat and clothes to wear. In other words, give me what I need day by day by day. One day at a time. That's all he's asking for. And at the end of his life, he testifies. Remember that he lives to be, was it 147 or something like that he lives to be? And he says at the end of his life, Genesis 48, verses 15 and 16, he says, he blessed Joseph and said, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed me all my life long unto this day, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and let my name be named on them. So in other words, what's he saying about God? I asked for God to feed me day by day, the God which fed me all my life long unto this day. You know, if he'd had a string of days where he didn't get any food, he would die. But every single day, God gave him what he needed. When he was afraid of his brother Esau, the Lord delivered him out of that trouble. When he was being cheated by Laban, the Lord delivered him out of that trouble. Every time a difficulty arose, the Lord brought him through. Now, most of us, all of us perhaps if we're honest, if we had the choice, we'd rather say, well, actually, I'd rather just not have the problems at all, Lord. I'd rather just not have the obstacle that you're going to get me round or get me over or the difficulty you're going to bring me through. Just make the difficulty go away. That'll be fine. Just don't let it arise. And just give me a nice, smooth ride, and that'll be fine. And if we're honest also, we don't really want, you know, give us this day our daily bread. What we'd really rather have is like to be able to open the pantry and say, oh, there's a good big store there for the next 6 months. That's fine. I'd like to be able to go to my bank account and say, that's plenty there. Even if disaster happens, I've got plenty to fall back on. We'd like to be able to say we've got abundance to say to our soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many days. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But the Lord might say to us, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. So the Lord gives us what we need each day, each occasion that we need it. And the Lord has already gone before Timothy, giving him all that he is going to need. If he's going to need courage to go with Paul and to go under the knife for the circumcision and so on without any kind of anesthetic or anything, he's going to need that courage. The Lord has given him that courage. The Lord has given him the head knowledge of the scriptures and the faith to apply them. The Lord has given him all these tools, all this equipment, and also all that he learns from Paul as he goes along the way, so that when he comes to lead the church in Ephesus, as he has to do later on, or when he goes on the journeys that Paul will send him on, he will have the equipping of everything that he needs. You could say, well, that's the good news. We might regard it as bad news, although it's not bad news, it's just really God's perfection, is that God will give you everything you need. But the other side of that coin is you're going to end up needing everything God gives you. I'll say that again. God will give you everything you need, but you are going to end up needing everything God gives you. He doesn't give you additional junk to have to carry. Even if you think of Paul's own situation, you might think, well, he was brought up a Pharisee. He can use that. That's fine. He also had Roman citizenship. You might think, that's not going to be much use to you if you're going to bring in a countercultural new spiritual kingdom. And yet we find he uses his Roman citizenship. He ends up needing it. It ends up being of benefit for the gospel. He ends up being able to, the fact that he can speak Greek as well as Latin, as well as Hebrew and all the rest of it, that he's multilingual. He uses that. Everything the Lord has given him, he gives him everything he needs, but he's going to need everything that he has given. And Timothy, no doubt, would have been in situations where the fact that he had become circumcised would work to his advantage. But at other times, the fact that his father was a Greek would give him an inroad to some places where a full-blooded Jew might not have any access at all. And the fact of his knowledge of the scriptures from a child will equip him to debate or to discuss with people who might think they were a bit cleverer than him because they were older than him. But he's got the tools that he needs. He has everything he needs, but he's going to need everything that he has given. It's not that the Lord doesn't give us anything spare. It's that if you have something spare, you can guarantee you're going to end up needing it. David Wilkerson, the 20th century evangelist who began the teen challenge work in New York to help drug addicts and gang members and so on to come to know the Lord. There was one occasion when, you know, each time they needed money for the work, they prayed and they trade it in, as it were, and the money would always come in, whether it was in dribs and drabs, and maybe children or youngsters sending in their few dollars, or others making big donations. And every month, he found it was incredible. It was almost exactly right, exactly what they needed. But this particular month, there was $200 more than usual. He didn't like to be quibbling, saying, "Lordy, why do you give us that extra?" He said, "Well, it's always nice to have a little extra," but he thought it was strange. Because every month they'd almost always had just exactly what they needed, almost nothing spare. And here was this $200 extra. And he thought, okay, well, we'll just hold on to this just now. He had a meeting with his lawyer, and the lawyer said, "Look, you realize that all the work I do for the Teen Challenge, for the charity, I never charge you a bill." And he said, and he thought, okay, fair enough. We always thought you just kind of done it as a friend, but fair enough. Anyway, he says, And I'm not charging a bill now, but the thing is that because of some situations arising with some property or they're buying or whatever, that this other person we've had to employ, they submitted a bill. We're going to need more money this month. And he said, "How much money?" He says, "Well, you know, these costs can't be contained." He said, "How much money?" He said, $200. There was the extra money the Lord knew he was going to need. And supplied it without them even knowing the situation. Now, of course, everything in our life doesn't come down to exactly that neatness. But it is an example, both for Timothy, for Paul, for a modern example there of how when we live by faith, the Lord will give you everything that you need, but you will need everything that the Lord gives you. So it was for Timothy. So we will find it to be also for us. It's not a bad situation to be in. You know, we brought nothing into this world. It certainly will take nothing out of it. But in the meantime, between the day of our birth and the day of our death, the Lord will, as he did for Jacob, he will feed us each day. He will provide everything we need. And if we are seeking to serve him with what he has given us, then he will utilize everything he has given us. And if we need more, he will provide the more. And if we ask for the more, he will either give what we ask, or he'll show us a way to be able to use what we already have. But everything you need, the Lord will give, or perhaps has already given. And whatever else you need, he'll supply. But whatever you've been given, it's because he wants you to use it. It's because he intends you to use it. And it's because you're going to need to use it if you're going to serve the Lord in your life. So it's something for each of us to think about and to recognize, what is it the Lord has given me? How am I able to use it for his service? If I think, well, he wants me to do this, but I can't do that because I haven't got this or this. Ask and he will give. If you don't need it, he'll enable you to do what he's asked without the thing that you think you need. He will give whatever you need, and you will need everything that he gives. When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, the Lord is way ahead of us. And I am persuaded that in thee also, wherefore I put thee in remembrance that thou stir up the gift of God. It is the gift of God. Which is in thee by, that was simply the instrument, not the power of itself, by the putting on of my hands. For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Everything you need, God has given. But everything God gives, you will end up needing and using to his glory. Let us pray.